Earlier today, an organization called the Victory Institute released an open letter to Donald Trump signed by 156 LGBT elected officials across the country, including Carrboro Mayor Lydia LaBelle and Carrboro Alderman Damon Siles. It's a long letter. You can get it online at victoryinstitute.org, but it reads in part, "We believe in an America that values and accepts everyone, in the country that strives to improve quality of life for all people, regardless of their background or beliefs. These principles are what make America great, and it is the elected leadership of our nation that determines whether our government embodies or undermines those ideals. It is elected leaders like ourselves that either appeal to the better angels of our fellow Americans or use fear and rancor to spur unproductive discord. While we hope you appeal to those better angels and support inclusive and fair-minded policies, we have grave concerns given the individuals appointed to your administration thus far." Again, full letter online at victoryinstitute.org. We're joined now by Carrboro Mayor Lydia LaBelle, who is one of 156 signees of that letter, including four elected officials here in North Carolina. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and happy that this letter is now kind of out in the public sphere. It's something that we've been working on over the course of the last couple weeks. I think perhaps in December I mentioned to you I attended a conference for a Victory. It was an elected leaders like national conference in Washington, D.C. in early December. And at that time, well, first of all, when the conference was being organized, as it is every December, the thinking was that it would be a discussion of how to further increase the number of appointees in the presidential administration. And then after the election, the agenda changed a little bit. And so there was a pretty lengthy discussion on what should our outreach be to the incoming president. And this letter that you see is the result of that conversation.
What is the benefit of open letters like this?
Well, I would say that probably folks have a variety of ways that they would consider when trying to approach a new administration that you're not certain is going to continue with the policies of the previous administration, right? So if I guess you have people at one side that might say, don't do anything, fight back, don't engage, don't let the administration placate. At the other far end, you might have optimistic persons such as myself that might say, as we have done previously, you know, maybe we should get a group together, maybe we should meet with the president, maybe we should, you know, talk about goals and objectives. But then I think clearly, I think something that no one wanted to do was do nothing, right?
Right.
So to come up with an open letter where you get the force of a really large number of individuals across the United States signing on a statement, a pretty powerful statement, wordsmithed quite a bit over the weeks. I think I told you I haven't looked at the final version today, but I know that a lot of care went into making it specific, but also making it, you know, broad as to principles of equality and so forth. I think it sends a really powerful statement from those of us at the local level and at the elected statewide level to say to our president, look, don't turn us backward on this. Let's keep moving forward.
And obviously that's one of many things that can be done. The nice thing about an open letter is it doesn't close off any other doors, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And it does suggest that I know that it does suggest don't forget us, consider
right.
us. In a brand new administration like this, everyone wants the ear of the president, or everyone wants the ear of the president's appointees or departments. Everyone fears, what's this going to do for my constituency or whatever? And so, you know, at least what it does is kind of put it out there, don't forget about us. Now, maybe after things get a little more settled, people get in place, more personal type conversations of a more one-on-one nature, I think, can take place or should take place. You know, clearly, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything to be gained by no contact whatsoever for 4 years.
Yeah.
But I think that there is, there is some trepidation and some fear by folks that, you know, that LGBT rights are going to be slashed or go backward over the next 4 years. So to make certain that our voices are heard, I think, is important.
Yeah, especially when you're considering someone like Donald Trump, who at various points over the course of the campaign at least paid lip service to the LGBT
right.
community in a way that other Republican candidates had not done and would not have done if it had been someone else winning getting the Republican nomination, and then he wins the election, and now we've got one cabinet appointment after another. You know that whoever it is he ends up nominating for the Supreme Court is going to be someone who is almost certainly hostile to the LGBT movement, and will rule accordingly if confirmed at the Supreme Court. So this is almost kind of a put your... Like the one thing that you can say to Donald Trump, put your money where your mouth is. Right.
Yeah, and you know, his hazy kind of populist, ever-changing remarks on LGBT equality. I mean, he hasn't said the most terrible things about LGBT equality. However, he has surrounded himself with people who have.
As
you say, you know, for instance, you know, our incoming vice president, who as governor of Indiana, did not speak out for gay rights.
Yeah. Signed the RFRA.
Right. Yeah. But there are every member of his cabinet. I don't have it in front of me of his proposed cabinet. I don't have it in front of me right now. Almost every single one of them, to a person, when you went to their positions on LGBT rights, they were non-existent or they were very much against LGBT rights.
Was it Jerry Falwell Jr. called it the dream team?
There
you go.
Or the nightmare team.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Right.
And speaking with Carver, Mayor Lydia LaVelle, and obviously outreach to others in positions of power in the federal government as well, I have to assume, because the one thing I was thinking about when I was watching Donald Trump, reading about, I guess, because I didn't watch it, Donald Trump's press conference, such as it was the other day, where you've got a whole bunch of reporters in a room who are reporting on what Trump says in the press conference as if we don't all know, that has virtually no bearing on whatsoever on what he's actually going to do. Like, we know that about Trump at this point. So at this point, I'm thinking, if you're focusing your energy on Donald Trump and trying to understand from his words what he's going to do or try to lobby him to change his behavior, I almost think that effort is misplaced and we should be focusing our efforts instead on the people in power in Washington who can check and balance Donald Trump. Focus on Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, the people who are actually going to be in the cabinet, Mike Pence even. Like, what can we do to encourage them to be a force that's willing to stand up to Trump if and when, and probably sooner rather than later, he starts going too far?
Yeah, well, it might be an effort to find allies in the opposite party. It's clearly a lot of all the Democrats are allies, but to find that moderate Republican, to find that moderate, highly elected official in the Trump presidency, to find maybe the LGBT appointee or high-ranking worker who is known or not known to kind of speak to realities of today's world. Another source to kind of have an open conversation might be Trump's children. Most young people, see the benefit of LGBT rights, believe in LGBT rights, a lot of them, and even, even Republican, members of the Republican Party. And certainly, while I don't agree with, a lot of what his children have said, they have a certain kind of, I think they have a certain kind of slightly more open ear to issues like this. And so that might be a way to kind of get it. Or dare I say, even his wife. I mean, who knows? So you kind of think, and this, we've seen this over the months, his sphere of influence, and he has said it, is his family, or his children, and his children who are now running his empire. Unfortunately, one way to look at it is it makes good business sense also. We see that in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So it might be, there are more than one, there's more than one way to try to address it or try to get the word through. But, let's face it, it's going to be a rough 4 years no matter what happens.
Looking at what has been done, his actions, disregarding the words, just looking at the actions, what is it that's concerned you the most? And what is the one thing that you can look for, if anything, as a sign of hope?
Actions, I would say, clearly his appointments. Most specifically, I'll talk about his appointment for Attorney General.
Sessions.
I mean, it's just, I can't even imagine a more a huger difference going from Loretta Lynch to Jeff Sessions. I was watching something the other day that was an interview of his previous interview, I think to be on the judiciary in the 1980s or something.
Oh, right,
yeah. And I mean, he got rejected then.
Yeah.
People were speaking out then against a lot of the views
by
he had.
By a Republican-controlled committee at the time, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And so I'm not sure what has happened in the last 30, 40, 50 years that suddenly now he's qualified to be the Attorney General of the United States. So that is just, it's really almost an horrific appointment, I think. And just the stark, I mean, the difference in him and Loretta Lynch, I think, is incredible. And that has lots and lots of implications.
And we've talked about this in the context of House Bill 2 and Part 1 of House Bill 2 and the Gavin Grimm case. And that entire legal issue revolves around the decision of the Obama Justice Department to interpret the Civil Rights Act and the Education Amendments in a broad way. And that is done now, basically.
And absolutely in every way. You know, to defending cases that need defendant, to bringing forward cases that need to be brought forward. I mean, just the list could go on and on. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, I'm talking right now about LGBT rights, but any kind of rights involving any group of persons mm-hmm. that you can think of that are disenfranchised.
Well, Sessions with the reason why he got rejected in 1986, right?
Exactly. So that's really terrible. And then I guess you said, what's the most encouraging thing? Having to kind of look for that. I mean, I will say that I think over the years, Trump has waffled on gay rights. And I honestly think he is not as far right as most of the folks in Congress. And it might be some of what we saw a little bit here in North Carolina, that he might be acquiescing on that because, you know, he has other fish to fry or other things he's worried about. But, you know, again, I hate to say it comes down to business, but from a business acumen, it's hard to say how he'll settle in, but perhaps the influence of his kids might help him maybe not be as aggressively against gay rights as some fear he may be.
I'm speaking with Carper Mayor Lydia Lavelle, and you can get the full open letter, by the way, on the web at victoryinstitute.org. Again, 156 LGBT officials, elected officials from around the state and around the country signing on to this, including Mayor Lavelle and Damon Siles of the Board of Aldermen. So let's talk locally. We had a board meeting in the midst of the snow and ice recovery. Board of Aldermen was able to have the board meeting on Tuesday. So what took place there?
Yeah, we did have our meeting on Tuesday night because, you know, the community started coming back a little bit to normal on Tuesday afternoon. It was a pretty abbreviated agenda already, which was nice. But one of the items we did talk about was our body-worn camera proposed policy. And so many listeners are aware of this, that over the course of the last couple of years, our police department has been working very closely with a couple of board members, Damon Siles, Sammy Slade, and also with ACLU and other attorneys, our attorneys, to come up with a policy to be implemented if and when we purchase body-worn cameras that provides, you know, maximum transparency, that's of benefit to not only citizens or the public, I should say, but also to our police department and to our chief in particular, who also could use it to, you know, try to, help with, the actions of his employees, like point out good things, point out bad things. I mean, it's an evaluation. It's a method of evaluation as well as a method of, you know, looking at an after-the-fact occurrence and trying to see what happened. So we worked for some many months on a really what we thought was a good draft policy, entered the General Assembly last summer, passed a policy that all departments that purchase body-worn cameras must adopt before going forth with body-worn cameras. And so Tuesday night was a presentation by our police chief to talk about our policy and how it now has to kind of read in light of requirements by the state. And we had an ensuing public discussion just among the board members, and the board's, you know, really kind of split on, you know, do we want body-worn cameras? And definitive, no one coming up down definitively one way or the other on it for reasons that, you know, have been in the press and for what I'm saying, that you know, the state policy, while it has some good parts to it, it does have some good parts to it, but the part that concerns most people is that The ability to make it open or open to the public,
right,
or turned over or whatever really predominantly rests in the hands of the law enforcement officer, you know, the chief law enforcement officer. In our case, our wonderful police chief. But, you know, in another county or another town, it might be another police chief or another sheriff. So that's the concern. And our board talked about it for a long time and then decided we wanted to have a public hearing. It'll be our public hearing date in February, which is February 28th. And we really want to hear from the public about this and get their sense of, you know, whether they think we should move forward given the pros and cons of the policy we now are required to adopt. I know that there are folks, we're going to be talking to our legislative delegation about our concerns with the statewide policy, as many have. I know that there are folks trying to gather and try to create or encourage some draft legislation to amend the statute a little bit to make it a little more in line with what agencies such as our department in Greensboro and others would prefer. And so we want to have a conversation with the community. I know that, you know, our different boards would like to hear from them. We'd like to hear from citizens.
Right.
So anyway, pass the word on that because we're really interested in hearing about
it. That's going to be in February. How much discretion does like Carborough Police or the Carborough Police Chief, whoever that should be down the road, because if this policy continues, how much discretion would they have to decide to release body camera footage?
Well, certainly immediately it's only in the hands of the chief. Mm-hmm. And then if and when it does get released, there's a mechanism whereby it has to go through like a court order.
Okay.
So I'm going to understand the particulars of it more too before the public hearing. But the point being that it can't be requested by, say, the elected body,
right,
or it can't be requested by, you know, the mayor or the town manager or whatever. You know, it's the discretion is in the hands of the chief. And one of the points I made, which is kind of interesting, is in a lot of communities, well, in all communities, the police chief is hired by either the council or the town manager,
right?
But, you know, this also includes, for example, sheriffs, you know, and the sheriffs are accountable to no one except the general public, right? I mean, that's a huge, you know, that's huge. And it kind of ultimately is our way with the police chief. There's just several more layers. But in terms of, you know, that it just puts a lot of discretion in the hands of what may be officials that really have no need for any accountability other than, you know, wanting to be reelected.
Suppose in the case of you know, the Carborough Police Chief, the Board of Aldermen and the town manager have the discretion to hire who they want. So the next time that job is open, the Board of Aldermen and the town manager could look for someone who's really deeply committed to transparency.
Right. And you know, and I would say, and our police chief, of course, is deeply committed to transparency. And we included like some extra language in our policy that says this shall be interpreted to the largest degree possible in terms of transparency. But yeah, your point is, you know, if a police chief, you know, did something terrible or I don't want to keep saying police chief because it makes sense, but whoever the person is in leadership, if they did something terrible, well, ultimately the town manager or city manager could fire them and hire a new person. Whereas if you had the sheriff do something, well, you might have to wait three or four years and have an election.
Right.
And then it's a little different. Then you have maybe people that are uninformed and all that. So.
All right. So we'll keep following that. And then the meeting, the public hearing is February what day again?
Yeah. It'll be, it's on February 28th is our public hearing date, the fourth Tuesday in February.
A month and a half from now. So mark your calendars for that. We got to let you go. But Mayor Lavelle, thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
And again, victoryinstitute.org if you want to read that open letter.